Hello and welcome to episode 16 of our weekly podcast, Long Shots, or shall I say the season finale. Yes, we have been through 3.5 months of a podcast where we have discussed everything ranging from business, finance, and pretty much anything we find relevant, interesting, and intriguing. But today is slightly different. Before going any further, I would like to point out to our listeners that we are now streaming on Apple iTunes, Deezer, Spotify, and pretty much any podcast app that you might like. So do subscribe, do share our content. Once you subscribe, remember, you'll get a nice little notification every time the podcast goes live. So that will make your life also easier. So this is Nikhil Arora. I have with me Sharad. Sharad, how's it going?
It's going very well. It's good to be here. I can't believe it's been, what, 3.5, 4 months now, episode number 16, and I've thoroughly enjoyed every one of those. And I'm really looking forward to today's episode, especially because we have something special going on.
Yes, man. I think the listeners will also look forward to listening to more than two of us.
Yeah.
So now we have a very special guest with us. We have Dr. Arun Chopra. People who follow us on Transfin must be very familiar with his work. He has been actively commenting on health and nutrition related topics, since July or August. And in terms of Dr. Chopra, he's a director of cardiology at Fortis Amritsar. He did his DM cardiology from AIIMS, where he also worked as an assistant professor. He's fellow of many international medical bodies, has written excessively on very well-reputed journals. So we are very, very fortunate to have him out here. And he obviously has a very special interest in health, diet, and fitness. And that's what we are going to talk about here. Dr. Hi. Chopra, pleasure Hi. To have you here.
Thank you. Hi, great to be on your show.
Great. So, I think the best way to kind of go about it is to start from the start. Right. In terms of, like, we are obviously familiar that your interest in nutrition and fitness is beyond medical interest. You also practice it regularly in your own life, and you have also succeeded and brought a lot of personal milestones in that regard. So, let's start with how did this area became something of interest for you?
Great to start from the beginning, Nikhil. What happened was that. As a child and as a young boy, I was always overweight. And in my life, if you ask me how much weight I have lost, I must have lost over 100 kg, which means 10 kgs 10 times.
Oh, wow.
So that is interesting because like most other people, I could lose weight, but I could not keep it off. And I, between the age of 15 and 40, I did this about 8 to 9 times. So each time I lost 10-12 kgs, kept it off for maybe 6 months, and then gained it back within 1 year or so. And by the time I was 40, I was well established in my work. So, the need to study more for developing my work became less of a priority. And general health and the advice that I was giving my patients who wanted to know what they should do in order to remain fit became very important. Therefore, I decided that I need to study why is it that people can lose weight but then not keep it off, start losing weight, then taper off, and gradually become overweight again, lose fitness as they age, and why people say that they eat nothing at all and yet continue to gain weight and feel weak all the time.
Right.
I've heard that so many times, yes.
Yes. And you can't believe how many times I've heard this in my OPD, especially from females over the age of 40.
Right.
They have this persistent problem. So I was intrigued because there is nothing in the teaching of cardiology or medicine which actually tells you great deals about nutrition, everyday nutrition. Right. So I studied it on my own. And I started over 10 years back.
So I think the biggest requirement for you was obviously you personally felt this problem. You got a lot of feedback from patients. So there was a point in your life when you got some time.
Sure.
You started getting some time to actually study this in detail. Like, how did you... You first went online, you first went to a library. How did you kind of, go through that entire journey?
Oh, yes, it is a very difficult journey. The problem is that whenever you go to a gym, typically gym trainers ask you to have a routine where, they ask you to exercise one body part today, another body part tomorrow, and they ask you to eat more proteins and less fat and less carbs. And none of that makes any sense. because you really don't know what to do. You don't have the nuts and bolts. Anyway, so I also started with exercise, you know, exercising my biceps one day and triceps another day and the chest another day. And it gives you initial benefit. You lose some weight, you become somewhat stronger, but there everything stops.
Yeah.
Then nothing seems to work. So then I went into the original diet books, the original books on nutrition, which were written, some of which were written decades ago.
Right.
And I found that there has been a change in the thinking on nutrition about 50 years back.
Right.
Up till 1950, 1960, it was clear that fats were okay, mm-hmm. proteins were healthy, fruits and vegetables were okay, good to have. Carbs, everybody knew that if you have too many carbohydrates, especially sugars, colas, refined carbs, you tend to gain weight. Everybody knew this till about 1950 or 1960.
Right.
Until in 1960s, 70s, some Americans did some studies and thought that dietary fats are contributing to heart disease. And then they started recommending that you cut down on fats.
Yeah.
And over the last 50 years, we have seen that fats been cut down. And if you are not going to have butter, you're going to have something else.
Yeah.
So you will invariably end up having jam.
More carbs.
Now, is jam better than butter?
Right.
I'm not so sure.
Right.
But this is what has happened. So what we needed to do was to find out that how you can eat in a practical manner.
Right.
A diet which you can continue over a lifetime and not get tired of in a maybe 6 months or a year, because I realized that you get tired of diets.
Yeah.
You get tired of exercising without tangible benefits.
Right.
So I guess sustainability is at the core.
Absolutely.
Right, in terms of diet and lifestyle.
Absolutely.
Right. So like in terms of like obviously I think there, so there's been a change in narrative, right? So there was a narrative where carbs were the main culprit, and then the narrative shifted to fats becoming the main culprit, and I think now in the last few years we are kind of coming back to the original narrative to some form of fashion. But I assume that this is not as black and white, right? It's not like all fats are good, it's not like all carbs are bad.
Absolutely.
Right? There must be some line in between. Would you kind
sure.
of what was your understanding of that?
Yes, I think the shift towards carbs being good and fats being bad started in late 70s,
right?
And it continued for about two decades.
Right.
In late 90s, the realization came about that after cutting down fats, actually obesity has increased. In the last 30, 40 years, there has been a...
Because I still recall your quote, you know, you always say that there's never been a time when there's a rampant obesity and rampant presence of gyms at the same point of time.
Absolutely. I think I wrote that.
I thought I need to put that in. Sorry.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So by end of 90s, it was realized that fats are not all bad.
Right.
And low carb came in, high fat came in.
Right.
And for the next few years, that reigned. But ultimately, it was realized that neither very low fat nor very low carb is great.
Okay.
So what we now realize is that there is probably something which is known as a U-shaped curve.
Okay.
Which means that with very low consumption of a macronutrient and very high consumption, you have increased health problems.
Right.
With a moderate intake, you have least possible health problems. So you understand the concept of a U-shaped curve.
Right.
So if you are taking 10% fat,
right.
that's bad for you.
Right.
If you are taking 70% fat, that's bad for you.
Right.
If you are taking between 30 and 40% of your calories as fat, that's optimal.
Okay.
Similarly, if you are taking 10% calories as carbs, that's bad for you. But if you are taking more than 60% calories as carbs, that is also bad for you. So something like 40 to 50% calories as carbs is optimal. And what remains, something like 20% or so, 20-25% should be proteins.
Proteins, right.
So this is from a dietitian or a nutritional perspective.
So like a 40-40-20 split.
Something like that.
Kind of goes. But like, I think it's very, like it obviously sounds like a very structured framework. But when one is practicing it, one is not really measuring
Absolutely.
The percentage. So like in terms of thumb rules, if I ask you, you know, like, okay, if you're looking at fats, what do you think is should be off limits or should be minimal? What do you think is acceptable? Similarly for carbs, how would you kind of split that
you know, from a day-to-day consumption perspective.
To engineer, let's call it a balanced diet.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that is the big question. The problem is that guidelines, when they change, people take one line in the guideline out of context.
Right.
For instance, you must have read many WhatsApp forwards that cholesterol and fat are now removed from the naughty list and you can have anything. Whereas this is factually true that cholesterol and carbs were removed from, there were no upper limits on them.
Right.
These upper limits were removed some 2-3 years back,
right,
by all leading healthcare societies. That doesn't mean that you go and have fried foods or samosas or sweets or, you know, whatnot, which you have,
right,
the puris, which are so commonly found in,
right,
north of India.
Right.
So what it means is that you are free to consume reasonable amounts of healthy fats.
Right.
So what are healthy fats?
Yes.
Healthy fats are fats, one, in milk and dairy products.
Right.
They are by and large healthy. Especially curd, cheese, they are very healthy. Then you have nuts and seeds. They are extremely healthy. You can have them in good amounts. A handful of nuts every day, whether it's almonds, whether it's walnuts, whether it's cashews, pistachios, or even, you know, the humble peanut.
Right.
They are all good.
They're all good.
In fact, peanuts you can take somewhat more than one handful.
Right.
So these are the sort of things which are healthy.
And they work well for snacking.
They work very well for snacking.
Right.
So instead of having your cookie or your cake, it's better to have a handful of almonds or a,
right,
couple of walnuts,
right,
or a handful of peanuts.
Right.
That makes a much more filling snack.
Right.
They will give you healthy fats,
right,
and they will keep you full much longer.
Right.
Because one of the concepts I have tried to explain in my article is, why do we crave carbs?
Right.
We crave carbs because carbs typically get digested within 2 hours. You would have seen this if you go to a mall or if you go to a cinema hall.
Right.
If you have popcorn and cola in the beginning of the film, you will invariably end up having something again in the interval.
In the interval.
Because 1.5 hours or 2 hours down the line, you have digested those 200-300 calories.
So it has been absorbed so quickly that you,
yes,
need the
cake
again.
You now have a trough of blood sugar levels,
right,
and you need a cake again to feel good again.
But then what would you say are carbs which are okay?
Exactly. So like I told you,
because I imagine the when you're talking of popcorn and, you know, like Coke or everything, those are basically refined carbs, right?
Absolutely.
So what would you prefer instead? Because carbs are essential, right? You don't say,
absolutely,
that carbs are not essential.
Not at all.
Right.
Exactly. As I told you, there is a U-shaped curve.
Correct.
So if we look at things like colas,
right,
sweetened beverages,
right,
they are empty calories.
Right.
Caramel popcorn, though very good to taste, are,
right,
practically empty calories.
When you say empty calories, what do you mean?
I mean they are calories without nutritive value.
Right.
For instance, you can have water, which is good for thirst,
yeah,
but doesn't give you calories.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, when you have a Coke, you get calories, but no nourishment. When you have milk, you get calories, but you also get some nourishment. You get vitamin D, you get fat-soluble vitamins, you get some lactose, all of which are reasonably good things. So this is the difference. When you have eggs, you have calories, but you have nutritive value.
Right.
When you have chicken, you have nutritive value.
Right.
Similarly, when you have legumes, when you have fruits, when,
right,
you have vegetables, you have nutritive value.
Right.
Plus lot of complex carbs, fiber,
right,
which is very good for your system. So carbs that are good are fruits, vegetables, salads.
Complex
they are all
carbs.
Excellent.
So the complex carbs.
Yes,
right,
they are all excellent.
Right.
By vegetables, I mean vegetables other than potato.
Right.
Potato practically behaves like sugar.
Right.
Other than that, most fruits and vegetables are,
right,
good and healthy to have, and green leafy vegetables,
right,
and salads are actually,
right,
the healthiest.
Right.
So if we restrict carbs too strongly, we'll miss out on the vitamins, nutrients, fiber,
understood,
which are essential components of these things.
But like, you know, if you follow a 40-40-20 diet, is that a weight loss diet or is that a sustainable balanced diet?
I won't say exactly 40-40-20. I will call it fats 30-40,
right,
carbs 40-50,
right,
and remaining being proteins, which,
right,
can be 15-25. This, I think, is a healthy, sustainable diet for all normal adults.
Right.
These are adults who are not into health and fitness industry. They are normal you and me kind of adults,
right,
who are doing their normal work, and who need a healthy, nutritious diet, and who have maybe half an hour a day to exercise. This is a diet for those people to stay fit, stay healthy, have adequate strength to carry out all their normal activities, not get fatigued, have good sleep.
Right.
All those things.
That's very interesting. And I just want to ask another question, because, you know, last 8 years, I saw that there was a wave of veganism or vegan diet in the West. And interestingly, you talked about dairy and eggs and even meat. How do you think meat, and I personally am a big meat lover in terms of chicken and mutton and fish and whatnot, how does that fit in this entire scheme of things? I mean, I understand it's protein, but what do you think? What are your views on that?
So, two things. One is veganism. Vegan is a healthy lifestyle. You can consume healthy proteins and healthy fats, healthy carbohydrates if you are a vegan. There are several options available. But you can be unhealthy also if you are a vegan. See, you can have French fries even if you are a vegan. You can have Coca-Cola even if you are a vegan. So what I mean is, veganism doesn't mean health.
Yeah.
Right.
It is your choices
within
the particular dietary pattern that give you health. So the important thing is not macronutrients in particular. No fats are great. I mean, fats are not all great, not all bad.
Yeah.
Carbs
yeah.
are not all great, not all bad.
Yeah.
Same about proteins. But a balanced diet, what our grandmothers probably gave us,
yeah.
they are very healthy. We now find, after researching for 50 years, that what our grandparents used to consume was possibly quite healthy. Coming to the next part of your question about meats. All the data for meats tells us that if you talk about fish, marine, seafood is uniformly healthy.
Right.
And twice a week consumption of seafood actually gives you a lot of health benefits, not only in improving your lipid profile, but your blood pressure and reducing your risk of getting heart attacks and strokes. It's useful in all things. Next, we come to so-called white meats, chicken, etc. That is also quite reasonable. It's more or less neutral. It's not too good, it's not too bad. It's good in the sense that it gives you healthy calories, healthy proteins, and it doesn't have any correlation with increased risk of heart attacks or strokes. Now, at this time, you should understand that when I'm talking of chicken, I'm talking of chicken as a food. I'm not talking about KFC.
Right.
See,
yeah.
there
right.
are ways
sure.
of making chicken healthy and
right.
unhealthy, just as with all other meats. Meats, when we talk about red meats are the only meats about which questions have been raised regarding health concerns. Here you have to differentiate between processed red meats
right.
like bacon, salami, what you put on your pizza, stuff like that, or unprocessed red meats, which is fresh meat which you get in the market, you cook and eat.
Right.
The risk for fresh meat, unprocessed meat, is much lower, and the risk for processed meat is twice as high
okay.
as far as an increased risk of diabetes
right.
and an increased risk of heart attacks is concerned. What we find is that if you take more than 50 grams of processed meat every day, you have a twice as high risk of getting diabetes or heart attack on long-term follow-up.
Okay.
On the other hand, if you consume more than 100 grams of fresh red meat every day,
mm-hmm.
which I think very few people in India would be doing, then you have a half as much risk than processed red meat. This is the sort of thing. So for red meat, I would like to say occasional use, once
right.
or twice a week is good.
Right.
But daily may not be the best idea. Fish, chicken and turkey, all white meats, are much more acceptable, can be had regularly. Within these foods, there are ways of making it healthy and unhealthy depending
right.
upon how you cook them.
The medium, basically.
Yes.
So basically, sir, pepperoni pizza is now out.
Out.
Occasionally.
Occasionally. Only occasionally it's okay. So yeah, I mean, I think in terms of like let's kind of move on from nutrition to fitness.
Sure.
And in fitness, I won't actually, like, the way I'll probably ask the question would be something different. What annoys you about people's understanding of fitness? What is, like, if I ask you, like, what is the biggest thing which gets you irritated that, okay, look, you are not getting it right?
The most annoying habit is trying to find a quick fix.
Right.
Yeah.
See, fitness is not a quick fix. It's a lifestyle.
Hmm.
It's a mindset. You have to decide mentally to be fit, to be healthy, which means eating in the way healthy people should eat and exercising regularly.
It won't be a quick fix.
It will not be. It will never be.
Right.
Because if after 10 years you stop exercising or you stop eating healthy, 1 year down the line, you'll be back where you started from.
Right.
Wow.
So it's a lifestyle. It has to be its own reward. We can't be looking for short-term gains.
Right.
Fitness, the urge for fitness, the urge to eat healthy. And
so it cannot be an objective-driven, it's a process-driven
sure.
exercise, I guess, at the end of the day, right?
Sure.
In terms of, say, I am someone who doesn't do any physical activity in addition to like walking to work, waking up in the morning, you know, all those kind of very mundane things. I am kind of thinking about, you know, getting fit. Like when I say I am, it's just a case study. No, I'm not talking about myself.
Sure, I understand.
Just for the benefit of everyone. So if I am someone who has minimal amount of time and minimal amount of commitment, let's just say, to do anything fitness regarding, as a practitioner of fitness, what would be the minimum advice you would give me?
Well, Nikhil, first I will tell you that you are not alone as a case study.
Right.
Because only 8% of individuals in this world, adults, are actually regularly physically active.
Right.
And only about 35% are mildly active.
Right.
More than 62% adults in the world are sedentary.
Right.
And as they say, sitting is the new smoking. So
right.
If you don't get up for 1 hour from your seat, it's like smoking one cigarette. Therefore, the least you can do is get up once every hour from your seat,
right,
do something and come back
right.
rather than asking your secretary to hand you over the file.
Right.
It may be a good idea to just walk over and pick up the file.
Good thing is that benefit we don't have yet here. So,
though I was telling this to the case study.
Right.
That's very interesting.
Right.
But what I can say is that if you have maybe half an hour every day, and you feel committed to exercise and your current health is not great, a simple walk is the best way to start. Though a walk may not be the finest exercise guaranteed to give you highest levels of fitness, it will provide a basic level of fitness to everyone. And this goes on from, let's say, somebody who's 25 years old to somebody who's 80 or 90 years old. Anyone can start walking at any time and gain benefits from it, not only in terms of fitness, but also going out in the environment. Hopefully it's not in Delhi.
Right.
Hopefully it is somewhere where it is cleaner. Where you can smell fresh air, look at green trees and flowers, and that improves your quality of life and gives you mental relaxation. So the walk is the minimum you can start with. Within this, you can go on depending upon your current levels of fitness.
Right.
For instance, somebody is young. Let's say our case study is a 25-year-old gentleman who is otherwise fit. And if he has only 15 minutes a day,
right.
we can advise him some bodyweight exercising, some circuit training,
right.
which will give him extra advantages over and above the simple walk.
Right.
On the other hand, if our case study is a 65-year-old diabetic, hypertensive male patient who has trouble controlling his weight, his blood sugar and his blood pressure, there just the addition of walk can give him great benefits. I think I have written about this earlier that if one can walk 30 to 45 minutes every day,
yeah.
one can reduce one blood pressure medicine.
Right.
That means if 30% of the population is on one antihypertensive drug, they can lose that antihypertensive drug just by walking every day.
Right.
Similarly, it can act as much as one drug for the control of diabetes, because you can reduce your blood sugar by about 30 to 40 points just by walking for half an hour or 45 minutes every day.
Right.
Similarly, it helps you in losing weight and gaining muscular strength in all those ways. Therefore, the least you can do is to start walking on most days of the week.
Right.
Once you can do that for 6 months or 1 year, we can start on an incremental path. But that comes later.
That's very interesting.
Right. In terms of like, obviously like, I know that you have commented a lot on different types of exercise regimes, right? Obviously, when you're talking of like walking or running or cycling, that's more cardio oriented, aerobic style of exercise.
Sure.
But what I found very interesting was also the entire narrative on anaerobic style, which kind of has a much more long-term sustainable effect. And the best thing is it doesn't take a lot of time, right? But I'm a bit apprehensive of those regimes because I sometimes feel whether I have the knowledge or the skill set to crack it on my own. And I think the risk of injury is there. So if suppose I am a complete, you know, amateur and I want to kind of get into weight training, into resistance training, and I have no idea, let's say I cannot even afford to go to a gym. The only resource I have is probably have like a laptop with an internet connection where I can get some information. How do I approach this? You know, because, you know, the idea of exercising for a very short period of time every week being effective is very tempting. But on the way, you obviously want to minimize the risk of injury to yourself.
Absolutely. So that's a very interesting and important question that you ask. So what I would suggest is that it depends upon your current level of fitness.
Right.
As I said, a young man or a woman who's reasonably fit can start going to start just walking to start with. Then pick some bodyweight exercises.
Right.
There are lots of bodyweight exercises which you can do. I'll name a few of them. The push-up, the pull-up, the squat, the bridge.
How do I figure out the technique?
Yes. For that, you'll have to go to the internet.
Right.
You can get all this information on Google or on YouTube, how to practice these exercises, though this is not ideal. The
right.
ideal way would be to learn these from a coach.
Right.
But if you can't do that, the simpler exercises like the push-up, you can do even with reading from the
net. You know, the reason why I'm saying it's difficult to do it because, like, okay, let's look at an average gym. I think, Sharad, you were checking out a gym close by, right? Like fitness first. How much does it charge per month?
I can't remember. 5,000-6,000 rupees, I think.
No, it charges 5,000 to 6,000 a month, right? Let's say. Now, we all have busy lives, right? Effectively, the problem with the gym is unless you use it, it's almost equal to like burning money, right?
Absolutely.
So I think a lot of people cannot pass that psychological threshold of committing to a gym and paying for it at the same time. That's the reason why I think that's a real problem amongst, you know, especially I would say working like, you know, 20, late 20, 30 something lot who still have long hours to put in their work, who are obviously not making a lot of money, that they have a lot of disposable income.
Yeah,
right?
And a lot of gyms use this mindset to ask for 6 months locked in payment,
right?
Because they know if they do it monthly, then someone will fall off. And so there is it's a real issue.
No, but I think they are wiser than that. You would have seen that typically if you take a 1 month subscription, 1 month is lots. 3 months is much lesser, but 1 year is much, much lesser.
Yes.
Because they know that almost nobody is going to last a year.
Yeah,
right.
80% of people are going to drop off within 3 months. And that's why they do this. The only sense I can see in going to a gym is if you can get a good trainer there who can teach you some of these basic exercises. See, if you can't afford a gym, what are the choices we have? Choices are bodyweight exercises. Using
why you say body weight? Because body weight, there's a less risk of injury.
Yes, absolutely. There is a less risk of injury, and you don't need any permanent fixture in your house to do those exercises.
And because I guess by body weight, I mean you probably have an impulse to avoid injury, right? Because it's pretty much in your control. There's no external force, right?
See, the simple thing is, let's say you are trying push-ups.
Right.
Supposing you can do 10.
Yeah.
Then if you can do 10, you can't do 12.
Yeah.
If you try 11th or 12th, you'll just fall on your arms.
Right.
You'll fall on your chest. And you'll not injure yourself much in doing that.
Right.
On the other hand, let's say you are doing a bench press with free weights. And your current capacity is, let's say, 50 kg.
Right.
But no one stops you from showing off one day, you know, putting on 60 kg or 70 kg on the bar.
Correct.
Trying to lift it somehow with difficulty and then having the whole weight fall on your chest.
Right. Right.
And cause a lot of injury.
Right.
On the other hand, if we are trying a pull-up, we can either do a pull-up or we can't do a pull-up. So the tendency to injure yourself will be much lesser. That does not mean that if you can't do a pull-up, you just can't do it.
Yeah.
There are several options which are of lesser intensity and several options which are of greater intensity than the pull-up. So what I mean is that the pull-up is not one exercise but 10. The push-up is not one exercise, but 10. There are several books available on the net which you can read. So you have simple push-ups like table push-up. You have your hands on the table, your feet on the ground, and you are exercising against that. You have wall push-ups if you can't even do table push-ups. On the other hand, you have elite push-ups like one-arm push-up, which hardly anybody can do. So you have a wide range of exercise within body weight from everybody, from the newbie to the elite athlete. And everybody can do some sort of body weight exercise to gain both strength and resilience. However, you will have to make the effort once to learn the exercise properly. For that, you can go on the net, you can read books.
There must be a lot of YouTube videos.
There are lots of videos. Yeah. You learn what is reliable. You have to somehow learn.
And, you know, somewhat related to our discussion right now, how do we think about diet and workout in parallel? Like, I guess they cannot, can they be thought of it or thought of independently, or do they have to go in conjunction? What are your views around it?
That I think, Sharad, is a very important question, because I tend to find that people think that if they are exercising, they can eat anything and get away with it. I strongly disagree with this. I would like to tell you one line which you should memorize. You cannot exercise your way out of overeating. Because if we look at health, if we look at optimal physical fitness, or if we look at weight loss, I believe it is 80% diet and 20% exercise. Exercise will help in maintaining weight loss. Exercise will also help in losing more fat and preserving muscle while you are losing weight. But it will never do away with the after effects of an indiscriminate eating habit.
Right.
So that's very important.
There are many case studies on this as well. Like, a lot of people who are going in the gym very regularly and then they show up and they're like, man, I'm still the same. You know, so I guess they forget that basic principle.
Sure.
Those Chola Bhaturas have to show up somewhere.
Yeah, those Chola Bhaturas, right. Yeah. Exactly. I think that Puri WhatsApp you got was from someone similar.
You know, what I find is that people who go to gyms typically in the first 3 months lose weight.
Right.
But when you meet them 1 year later, 75% are not going to the gym and are heavier. Of the 25% who are going to the gym, they are still heavier, though they are stronger also.
Right.
Yeah.
So by this way, you can actually predict the future. You know, you meet someone who's going to the gym regularly, but you see him eat and you're like, man, 1 year down the line, you'll be the same.
Yeah.
Right? So that I think kind of goes well.
No, that's actually very insightful in terms of, it's all about balance, right? In terms of diet and in terms of your entire lifestyle. So that's very insightful.
And that's why for completion of this exercise thing, I would also like to add that there are three components to exercise. One is aerobic exercise, which we commonly read about. Walking, swimming, cycling, running. All those things are aerobic exercise. They give cardiopulmonary or lungs and heart exercise, apart from adding some strength to the rest of the body. The second group of exercises is strength training. When we talk about resistance training, whether it's lifting free weights, whether it's machines, whether it's body weight training, whether it's using the humble kettlebell, these are all resistance training, which basically add to your muscle, give you bone and strength and muscle gains. But the third group of exercise is also very important, and that is flexibility. That is working on stretching, and the Indian system of yoga is especially useful in this. Because it gives the body some strength, but also a lot of flexibility, which is so important to avoid injuries as one ages. Therefore, a complete exercise schedule, if you want to wish for an ideal exercise system, should involve some components of all three.
Right. So, but if you look at our kind of example of that person, you know, who has constraints on time, constraints on, you know, equipment or training. Probably I would see cardio plus flexibility plus body weight as a reasonably okay mix in terms of exercise plan.
Absolutely. I think you can fit in anything if you have half an hour every day.
Right.
And I'm sure most people can spare half an hour every day. So you can focus on, let's say, riding the cycle or a brisk walk 3 or 4 days a week.
Right.
Couple of days you can do only stretching or yoga, or respiratory pranayam, the respiratory exercises. And another 1 or 2 days, you can do simple body weight training. If you learn how to do push-ups, pull-ups, mountain climbers, squats, burpees, you can do circuits of this. One circuit of these five or six exercises will take about 1 minute.
Right.
And if you do six or eight circuits, giving yourself 1 minute rest, in 10 to 15 minutes, you'll find yourself breathless, exhausted, and you have burnt a lot of calories
right.
and got a lot of fitness in return for just spending 15 minutes.
Right.
But this will be possible when you reach a particular stage in your level of fitness. So you can't start off with this.
Right.
So what I mean is start off with walking, start off with simple bodyweight exercises, but keep at it, build it up, set goals for yourself. You are not going to be able to do a one-arm push-up in 3 months or even in 1 year. But if you can't do a push-up today, you can hardly do a table push-up today. You can be sure that 6 months down the line, if you are reasonably healthy, you'll be able to do a push-up.
Right.
Now, if you can do one push-up 6 months later, I am sure 1 year later, you can easily do 10 or 12. If you continue within 5 years, you might realistically aim for a one-arm push-up also.
Right.
So, slow progress is important, but progress.
Right.
Yes. And another thing with the workout, I often see the narrative of more the better. More weights you lift, better it is, or more you run. If you're walking 5 kilometers, next you want to go. Like, is how important is rest in all this, and how do you tackle that?
The point is that at one stage you start reaching a point of diminishing returns.
Yes.
And it's important to stop before you reach that. For instance, the American Heart Association recommends that you do at least half an hour of exercise ideally on 5 days a week, which means about 150 minutes. Of exercise every week.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The most important benefits of walk will accrue within this limit. However, you can continue to work out for 2 hours every day and still get incremental benefits, but very soon you reach a point of diminishing returns.
Yes.
Therefore, you have to draw a balance between the time you have, your current level of fitness, and your goals. Not everybody wants to be size zero. Not everybody wants to do a one-arm pull-up. Most people would be happy just to be reasonably fit, just to be able to run upstairs one or two flights if they are in a hurry, just run and catch a train if they have to, lift a reasonably heavy suitcase, hoist it into the overhead compartment in an aeroplane without having to ask for help. Also, you know, squat down on the floor, clean something, or pick up something which has, you know, just accidentally fell down below the bed. Most people will be happy to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you are doing regular walks, if you are stretching regularly, and if you are doing some amount of body weight exercise daily, believe me, you can do all this even when you are 80. Now, what I find is that people stop exercising, and then one fine day at the age of 55 or 60, they find that when they have to hoist a suitcase into an overhead compartment, they pull their shoulder. When they have to lift a heavy bucket of water, they suddenly pull their back. These are the sort of things we don't want happening.
Yes. So what would be the age? Like, I think like 20s, late 20s is when people are predominantly fit, because I think there's a lot of movement. You know, you are studying,
true,
or you have just started working. I think post 30s, mid 30s is when that sedentary
habits.
And I guess, in this thing, as per you, sooner the better you start, right, and build a routine. So I think post 30s, you would say one has to make sure that something or the other is going on in the background.
Agreed.
Because I guess there must be an age when, because I see that, right, there's a lot of muscle loss at a particular age, right? And after that, I think every day that you stay inactive, it only accentuates.
True. You, I think, pointed out the cutoff age very rightly. And in the 20s, your hormones are good, your general physical activity is good, so
right,
you keep your lean muscle. But after the age of 30, there is a rapid decline. Scientific evidence tells us that we lose about 1% of lean mass, which means
right,
bone and muscle, every year after the age of 30, which means by the time you are 60, you've lost some 30-35% of your lean mass. By the time you are 80, it's over 50%. And this is in the absence of exercise. And I've told you that 65% people don't do any exercise, period. So these are the people who are going to have many, many problems as they grow older. In fact, after the age of 65, there is now scientific evidence to show that the maximum morbidity and mortality is due to heart attacks and strokes, but number two is due to orthopedic problems, musculoskeletal problems.
Right.
If somebody from standing position can just squat down on the floor and get up without support after the age of 60, this is the biggest predictor that he will not have a fracture by falling in the next 5 years.
Wow.
On the other hand, if somebody can't do that, and I see very many people who can't do that, their chances of slipping down, falling and injuring themselves are very high. After the age of 65, people get an average of 2 falls per year.
Right.
And you injure yourself half the times.
Right.
So there is a chance after the age of 60 to injure yourself at least once a year by falling. And if you are exercising regularly, you will avoid all that.
Right.
So the sooner, as you said, the better it is. I'm not saying that you wait till 30 to start exercising.
Right.
If you can start in your teens,
nothing like it.
Mm-hmm. But if you haven't started even till 30, maybe you've got settled into your job a bit, now is the time to start exercising. After 30, you must exercise regularly, and not just aerobic exercise, idly. Spare half an hour once or twice a week for some resistance training, for some strength training,
right,
to preserve your bones and your muscles. This problem of osteoporosis, which you see, you must have heard your vitamin D levels are low, mm-hmm, your bones are weak. Your parents must have been told that sometime or the other. It is only because we have stopped exercising.
Right.
If we continue to exercise, these problems won't be found.
And now we know what we'll do in the evening, Sharad.
Yeah.
Yes, we are both above 30, as you must have realized.
Yeah.
Anyways. But I mean, it's strange, the parallels between when to start exercising and when to, you know, start financial planning. The story is pretty similar, right? In financial planning also, you say, right, that you don't plan for retirement once you retire. You actually start when you are 25, 30. I guess you have to like accumulate it and then let it unleash in the... So lots of food for thought. Or maybe food was not the right word. Yeah.
No. Fitness is also a bank account.
Right.
You keep on exercising, you keep on healthy eating, and you accumulate benefits. And
right,
then you can draw on them sometimes. Once or twice in a year, you can splurge. And if you've been going through my articles, you would see that I recommend a weekly cheat meal,
yes,
to stay clean.
Yes.
Because if I tell somebody that, okay, you are not going to have any sugars, any fats, anything bad the rest of your life, believe me, 6 months down the line, he'll say, bang it.
Right.
To hell with Dr. Chopra and I will eat what I want.
Yeah, yeah.
And you will ultimately be worse off,
right,
than you are today. Therefore, it is important to allow cheating within this schedule. And that's why I say that if 6 days a week you stay clear, seventh day, enjoy. Have a sweet, have a snack, have the meal you were waiting to have. Maybe it's a puri, maybe it's ice cream, maybe it's a cookie, maybe it's a cake, doesn't matter. One day of a week, maybe two cheat meals a week are perfectly allowable if you remain clean the rest of the week and exercise regularly.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of has concluded on a, I would say, rather cheerful note, because there's a cheat day possibility as well.
Yeah.
Well, now I think, you know, we can probably switch gears here and move to something a bit more high level, a bit more macro level. Obviously, when you look at Dr. Chopra, like as a medical practitioner, I'm pretty sure you are on top of all the recent turmoil that has hit the healthcare sector in our country. And I have recalled and exchanging a lot of notes with you in that regard. And I think the thing that really struck me recently was, I think, a study by Lancet, which is an acclaimed medical journal, which spoke of the rising risk of physical violence on doctors in India, especially in big cities. I think as citizens of Delhi, we have seen some local examples also in that regard. So I just sometimes kind of, you know, think that obviously, like, the medical profession, it's a very respected profession. A lot of hard work goes into that. A lot of years and years of deep study, personal sacrifices go into that. Why is it that suddenly this entire field or profession, or so many high potential people, are getting, you know, trapped in this negativity, and, you know, also facing the physical risk of being injured by a patient or patient's family? So I'll kind of pass the mic to you there, and and, you know, would love to hear your thoughts on it.
Nikhil, this is of great significance, not only to me as a doctor, but to us as society, I think. And as you know, I have some strong views about this. But let us start from the beginning. What has happened is that in India, we earlier had the concept of a GP or a family physician who used to take care of most of our simple health problems like fever or childbirth or loose motions or things like that. And these were respected elders and they would not charge much. And often people would pay them not even in money but in kind. Like somebody who had who was a farmer would give him maybe a kg of vegetables extra to sort of compensate for his services. And that was all very well taken. At that time, high quality healthcare.
So like in terms of chronology, where do you think that time was when this was pretty much the protocol?
This was maybe in the early post-independence era.
Right.
Initially, in the first 10, 20 years, right. There were no high specialty
50s,
institutes.
60s.
Yes. In 50s, All India Institute of Medical Sciences and the PGI Chandigarh came up, to give you two examples in North India, which are both elite institutions in the government sector.
Right.
At that time, there was no private sector at all. All private practitioners were the GPs I was talking about. There were very few specialists. At that time, hardly anybody could afford or could have access to high quality healthcare.
Right.
So if somebody had a heart attack, his only choice was sitting at home, lying in bed for a month, taking painkillers and hoping that the heart attack won't kill him. Hardly anybody, the privileged few, could fly abroad to United States or UK. You heard of a lot of people going to Vilayat, which
right.
was UK,
yeah.
For their medical treatment.
Right.
However, all that started changing in the late 70s and 80s. In the early 80s, in some leading institutions of India, two of which I mentioned, AIIMS and PGI Chandigarh, they started performing these high quality procedures like
right.
angioplasties. I'm a cardiologist, so I'll talk about angioplasty and bypass. So in 80s, we had these procedures, but since there were only two or three hospitals catering to the requirement of the entire nation, whose population at that time was already over 600 million, we found huge waiting lists.
Yeah.
We found that if a patient wanted to get an angiography done in AIIMS, the waiting list would run into years, by which time most people would actually, half of them would die of their illness.
Yeah, right.
So it was obviously not a practical system.
Right.
But government also cannot be blamed. It did not have the resources.
So there was a capacity crunch,
yes,
basically. Right.
To set up so many hospitals.
Right.
So private sector started coming in late 80s. One of the first hospitals were the Apollo Hospitals in the southern part of India and the Scots Hospital in the northern part of India. These were two hospitals which had capacities to perform all high-class cardiac procedures, whether angioplasty or surgical. And initially, there was a lot of respect for these institutions, for the doctors working there. And I think people were happy that they could go and get their treatment done somewhere in India. Even though they also had their resource crunches, because the amount of population was staggering and the hospitals were too few, it was still all good.
Right.
However, in 90s and after 2000s, we've had a mushrooming of private centers doing these procedures. We've had a mushrooming of corporate hospitals. So what we found is that the cost of treatment has gone up tremendously. Whereas earlier, one would get a heart attack and either die of it or live with it, but not spend too much money, maybe spend 500 or 1000 in some basic medicines and the doctor's fees. Now it is possible to spend lakhs. So you can spend 2 lakhs or 3 lakhs in trying to get an angioplasty or bypass
surgery. But that's a function of the quality of
the
procedures,
yes.
And the care.
Yes. So everything is still good if the procedure is done and the patient does well.
Yeah.
The problem is that worldwide we know heart attack has a significant amount of mortality.
Right.
Even in the finest of hospitals in the world, 5 to 10% of people coming with a heart attack will die because of it. This is despite the best medical management, despite whatever procedures can be done. Now the problem is that people are not prepared to spend money on their health. They have generally not prepared for it. They have money kept for their children's education.
Yeah.
They have money kept for their children's marriage. They have some money these days kept for their car or for their annual vacation. But there is hardly any arrangement for health problems.
Right.
And health problems are going to hit everyone as one ages. So on the one hand, there is availability of healthcare, which is expensive.
So as a patient, I know that there's the optionality that I can be saved,
right,
but I've not really mentally allocated those kind of funds.
Right.
That kind of obviously creates, because that transition is ongoing, right?
Right. So you are now, you are ready to get expensive treatment done, which will strain your finances because
right,
you're not prepared for it. Now, if the patient lives, everything is hunky-dory. But if the patient doesn't live, unfortunately, that time suddenly people realize that we've spent so much money on this patient's care and it's all a loss.
Yeah.
Because the patient isn't coming back. And if it's a simple person, he will possibly accept it or maybe protest against it. But in today's troubled times, when the environment is politicized, when you have people trying to make their name, doing one thing or the other, it's very easy to incite emotions at that time. And the sympathy of everybody is obviously with the person who's lost his father or mother or brother or sister. And therefore, nobody hears what the poor doctor or hospital has to say. By saying this, I don't mean to say that there are no unethical doctors or unethical practices in hospitals. There would be,
yes,
I'm sure,
right,
as they are in all professions. But we should not hang them without a trial.
Right.
Unfortunately, an angry mob comes, breaks windows and doors of the hospital, breaks equipments, manhandles doctors, and that's not a good thing to happen. On the other hand, we have the same thing happening in district level government hospitals also.
Right.
Here for different reasons. Here the issue is that you are expecting care of a high class tertiary hospital, but not getting it. So you have this paradox here. There are a set of hospitals where you are getting tertiary care, but at expensive rates.
Yeah.
You are not prepared
mostly
to spend.
Private, mostly,
yes,
private.
Mostly private.
Right.
Where it is hard to spend the money on them. On the other hand, you have another set of government district hospitals, most of which are not geared up to manage very sick patients. So here the expectation is that you get lot of you get experienced doctors to look after you, you get equipment to look after you, but without spending any money, which
right,
will not work. So this is the paradox of the Indian population. In the government hospitals, you don't spend much money, but you also don't get too many facilities.
Right.
In the private hospital, you get a lot of facilities, but you end up spending much more money than you thought you would. And this is why the Indian patient is happy neither in the government hospital nor in the private hospital.
Because I guess most of them, like I read on insurance a lot. That's an area of my interest. I mean, obviously, insurance penetration is fairly low. So that obviously has an overhanging problem. It's not like according to you, the problem is not with the business model of the private hospital. The problem is with the lack of financial planning or security or expectation on the patient's end, correct?
Right. For instance, in United States, when you join a job, you know who's going to look after your medical insurance.
Right.
Whether
right,
it's your employer or whether it's you. Here, There is no mandatory framework. For instance, government has made it mandatory that when you buy a vehicle, you can't drive it out of a showroom without insurance.
Correct.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we have no such compulsion for a newborn baby. Whereas, I think that should be the case.
That's such an interesting analogy.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No. I mean, do you think there's anything wrong with the business model of private hospitals? No. I mean, I don't want to kind of. I mean, I'm sure there are, unethical practices. It depends from name to name. Like, you cannot generalize. I get that. But why is it that they charge so much? Like, are they justified in charging so much? Or is it a function of the kind of capital investment that they have to incur?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's a function of their initial capital investment. What you must understand is there is a big difference between setting up a government institution like the All India Institute of Medical Sciences or a reputed corporate hospital. In a government institution, the land is from the government, the building cost is by the government, The equipment is by the government. Again, it's the taxpayers' money, but nobody actually physically pays for it. On the other hand, when you do the same thing in private sector, you have to first buy the land on commercial rates. Then you have to get clearances on commercial rates. Then you build the building on commercial rates. You pay for electricity on commercial rates. And remember, electricity in hospitals is much more expensive.
Because they require backups and everything.
Yes,
right?
They require backups and they require high voltage. For instance, the cath lab requires high voltages.
Right.
So the cost of electricity to a cath lab is sometimes as much as half of the remaining hospital.
Right.
Because we need so much electricity. Then look at equipment. A typical cath lab costs over 3 crores. The amount of money which is given per year to the company for the CMC, the comprehensive maintenance contract, is about 10% of that. So
right.
About 30 lakhs.
30 lakhs.
So you are paying 30 lakhs per year in addition to the 3 crores you gave them in the beginning for maintenance of this lab. So when we say that in a hospital like AIIMS, you can do an angiography in 5,000, why does a private hospital take 12,000 to 15,000?
Because in AIIMS there's a budgetary allocation.
Yes.
And in the private hospital, obviously.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you remember that the private hospital has first set up the hospital,
right.
Then he's running the hospital, then he has to gain back his cost spent within a period of 5 to 7 years,
right.
And he has to be ready 7 years down the line in setting up a new cath lab, because in 7 or 8 years this cath lab is going to be defunct.
Right.
So these are the compulsions under which an Indian hospital works. Having said that, it's also important to remember that despite costs which look atrocious from an Indian point of view, and I agree to that, the cost of an angioplasty of let's say 2 lakhs or 3 lakhs does look atrocious from the Indian per capita income point of view.
Yeah.
But if we compare it with the cost in the West, it's less than 10% of that.
Right.
The average consultation fee in an American hospital for a super specialist would be something like $50 to $200. In India, it would be $10 to $20. An average angiography or angiography would cost maybe $3,000. We do it in about $200 or $300.
Right.
The average angioplasty again costs 10 times as much. The bypass surgery costs are around $50,000 in USA. And if we look at the cost in India, it's only $3,000 to $4,000. So if we compare any cost in India with cost in the West, it's less than 10%. Just a fraction of the cost incurred in the West. So if we look
at... I have to kind of interject on that point, because, you know, if you like talk of the West is a big blob, right? I mean, West has also different models in it. So if I ask you, I know podcast is probably not the best medium to talk of solutions for such a big problem. But still, if I ask you that, would you prefer a US-like model where it's insurance-driven? And let's face it, the reason why US treatments are also higher is because there's a lot of insurance money going in, and that's why it's artificially inflated, right? So would you prefer that kind of a model where pretty much everyone is insured, but treatments are expensive, patients don't care that much because someone is paying for them, and hospitals can operate on their commercial considerations? Or would you prefer like a more, I would say, egalitarian or socialist kind of model like in UK or in France, where there is more public spending, where actually the onus of secondary and tertiary healthcare is more on the public sector rather than on the private sector, be it NHS, be it, you know, spending allocations. So if I ask you, like, what do you think is a more optimum model, or would India require its own model? How would you think about it?
India, I think, would obviously require its own model because of its sheer size and numbers. And lack of percolation of facility to the distal, to the periphery, where it's needed the most. However, comparing between US and let's say UK and Canada, any day I would follow the UK or Canada system.
Right.
The US system is not a great system because it started initially in a very positive way. But what happened was that as people became more aware and more litigation started, medical care became less of caring for the patient, but became more of covering your own backside.
Right.
For instance, if anybody comes with even pain abdomen to a leading healthcare facility in United States, he would get up, he would get all investigations for a heart attack as well, even if it were obvious that he has gastritis or a ruptured appendix. So this is a problem which I find there, that they are spending too much money in covering their backside, and which is why, you know, all hell breaks loose if you've gone to US and unfortunately you have a health problem. On the other hand, the UK model and the Canada model are much better. There, they have a particular resource which they can use. Let's say they have 100 points which they can use over 1 year in taking care of their patients. They prioritize. They try to find out who are the groups of patients who will benefit most from this care.
Right.
On the other hand, we have American data showing that of all the budget spent on healthcare, 25% is spent in the last 6 months of life.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
This is something worth thinking over. Is it worth it spending
right.
all that much money at that time for those patients? What is really happening is that those people are staying on ventilators and life supports. None of their family is with them. The families visit them once on the weekend, and
yeah.
the insurance company is taking care of the bills. I don't think that's a great idea. The Indian system of healthcare, where the entire family participates in the care of the patient, is actually a very healthy model.
Right.
But we have to realize that we
but
have
that's
to...
that's also changing, right?
Oh, that's changing.
That's
right.
also unfortunately changing. I don't think
it's not the same.
Especially in urban areas.
It has
I guess that kind of big city parallel is seeping in.
Yeah.
But like interestingly, when you mention Canada, like obviously like Sharad, you've lived in Canada in terms of like in terms of healthcare, is that something that you have also kind of experienced or looked at in terms of, you know, how like what's the perception in Canada towards their own healthcare? Because I think everywhere people are generally more critical about how the system works at their own turf, and everything, grass always looks greener on the other side. Is that perception in Canada also there, or people are relatively happy with how things fall, like this entire points-based prioritization model?
I think it's somewhat of the latter. There is a sense of satisfaction amongst them. And I found that most of the comparison they draw is with the United States.
That how theirs is better.
How Canada's model is better. How we're so much better.
Right.
So in that context, I think there's a level of satisfaction. But I've also noticed that there is a perception of extreme excellence chasing. So even
right.
there's the smallest little incident, it gets put under the magnifying lens and they look for scope for improvement. So I
right.
saw that not just in healthcare, but across the society as a culture. So I would never see someone say that we're the best at it.
Right.
But I think deep down the perception is that we're pretty good at this. Like
right.
we've managed it fairly well. Obviously they think that things can be better and, you know, more accommodative for everyone. But I think generally there's a positive vibe is
right.
my understanding. But again, I've never looked at it from this lens specifically.
Right.
But that's a feeling I
But I guess we also have to correct for the fact that like while US is a 300 million people country
yeah.
and India is like 1.2 billion. Canada probably has
35.
So it's like, it's also, I mean, it's always very attractive to extrapolate models. But I guess as you mentioned that India would require its own models, we can kind of probably, you know, branch out and take the best of things, how they work all over the world. But ultimately, it would have to be something much more tailored to the realities.
Just trying to complete what Sharad was saying, lots of people in US are nowadays acquiring medicines from Canada.
Right.
Yeah.
Because medicines which were developed in US are actually cheaper in Canada and in Europe than they are in US.
Right.
And there were lots of protests about this in the last 5 years. And Senate is looking to correct this. But the trouble is that so many senators, after they are no more senators, are lobbyists.
Right.
They are lobbyists for pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah.
And if you are following US, which I think you are following more than I do, all their healthcare bills are modified to a large extent by the concerns of pharmaceutical
yes,
industry
yes,
as well.
Yes.
Even in India, I feel a lot of ills for which doctors are being blamed today are actually the ills of pharmaceutical industry.
Right.
See, the doctors don't fix the MRP of a drug.
Yeah.
That is done by the government in consultation with the appropriate agencies.
Right.
So it is not right to blame doctors for overpriced medicines.
Because I think it's the problem because they are the face of it.
Absolutely.
So they get blamed, right?
That is right. That is what happens. When there is something wrong going on with the, let's say, the billing process in the hospital.
Right.
Something wrong with the billing process with the drugstore. The doctor, being the admitting consultant, is the one who has to face the brunt of the patient's agony. And this is what is creating all this problem. The administration remains on the backside. The drugstore owners remain on the backside. The stent and the, you know, infrastructure providers, they remain on the backside. And we as doctors have to face the hostility of society.
Right.
Because they feel that they have spent money on our name.
Correct.
Whereas you would realize that the doctor actually gets a very small percentage,
yeah,
of the entire hospital bill.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is something which is found everywhere. As you were talking of India, I would also like to add this point that we need more spending from a public point of view on this.
Yes.
It is not really my place to say all this, but I can give my 2 cents worth. The point is that we are spending a very little amount of money on our healthcare system. As you might be knowing,
less than 5% of,
yes,
GDP.
Absolutely. I think about 2% or,
yeah,
less than that.
Yeah.
So what is happening is that 80% of secondary and tertiary care is being provided by the private sector. Only primary healthcare is being provided by the government sector. Not even all states can boast that they have one or two functioning tertiary care hospitals in their state capital or some other city,
right,
of their state. For instance, Delhi has many. Delhi has AIMS, Delhi has Safdarjung, it has Maulana Azad and so many others. But let's talk about other states. Let's talk about Punjab. There is hardly one functional cath lab. Let's talk about Chandigarh. There are 2 or 3. Let's talk about J&K. There are 2 functional cath labs.
Right.
So go to any state, hardly 1 or 2 cath labs for crores of populations.
Right.
How can they cater to them?
No, I absolutely agree with you on that point. And I actually feel that, especially for a country with our level of economic disparity, the state has to play a much bigger role. I mean, because at the end of the day, like, you know, interestingly, I think, Shara, that I was talking about this, like, I recently read this book by Michael Lewis called,
yeah,
The Fifth Risk. Now, that book basically documents how much of an important player the US government plays in day-to-day American life, which Americans are not even aware,
yeah,
of.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you look at weather data, if you look at healthcare, not healthcare, if you look at their, you know, Department of Commerce, how they're actually, you know, monitoring a lot of publicly relevant information, right? If you look at the Forest Department, which is, you know, involved in conservation of the environment, US, which has like a very big forested area. But the gist of it was that government, for government, public good is the main objective, right? So, and especially in a country like India, where, I mean, we have done the math that at the end of the day, the Indian middle class is not 400 million people, it's 70 million people.
Yeah.
You know, we actually had a couple of discussions on that how much is actually the Indian middle class. And if you look at a lot of analysis, at the end of the day, it's not 300 or 400 million people, it's just 70 or 80 million people who actually have the right amount of income group to be able to afford all these kind of services. The vast population of our country, almost 400 to 500 million people, are, you know, at a very low income level. So obviously, no wonder the state has to take a bigger interest in this problem, and they have to spend more, they have to set up more centers. I mean, a lot more. Like, I keep on wondering that why are they building so many IITs? They should build more All India Institutes, right? I mean, that kind of parallel goes in that as well.
There are 5 more new AIMS-like institutions which have,
right,
come up in the next rest of the country, and that's a good thing.
Right.
And I think more of these are needed. Probably our aim at the outset should not be setting up 100 tertiary care hospitals.
Correct.
That is not practical.
Yeah.
That will be too much for the government. On the other hand, we can provide secondary care better and reduce a lot of the financial burden on the patients.
Yes.
Because lots of people don't need an angioplasty or a bypass directly. They need care for fever. They need care for pneumonia. They need an appendix removed, they need a gallbladder removed. So we can have good secondary care,
so that
hospitals
can you start, right,
in the public sector, which will be much cheaper, with, and you can keep 1 or 2 good tertiary care hospitals in every state.
Right.
And after that, of course, the spillover will still go to the private sector, but instead of 80% going there for all their needs, it will be maybe 20 or 25% people going there for their special needs.
Correct.
On the other hand, the large majority of people needing admission would be taken care of by the public sector. And that will probably make patients happier, deliver more effective therapy. Patients will be more happy with the government as well. The doctor-patient relationship will get restored.
Right.
At the same time, when patients go to an expensive corporate hospital, they will go with this understanding that, okay, we've had reasonable treatment for a long time, but now we need something special. And if it can be provided in a government hospital, well and good. If not, we can go and get it done in a corporate hospital. Once the patient has this type of understanding, I think the relationship between the healthcare industry and society should improve.
I think that was a great summary and closing argument on that point. Definitely, it's a lot to think about. It's a lot to wonder about. And I think even the general wider public should consider all these extraneous factors before painting any particular sector or profession in a negative light. Dr. Chopra, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending your time with us here.
Yeah, it's been one of the most insightful conversations that I've been part of for a really long time. And I'm just glad that we have the possibility of sharing with our listeners. Really appreciate your time and thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you. And so with that out of the way, just a friendly reminder to all our listeners, do feel free to rate and comment our podcast. We all, like Sharad loves constructive feedback. I know that. I'm obviously a bit less tolerant to it, but please go for it and do comment and subscribe to our channel. And with that, we end our season one. We'll be coming back with season two. Beginning of January, I guess.
Yeah, new and improved new
kind
year.
Go back to the whiteboard or the chalkboard and, rethink things over. And yeah, so this is Nikhil.
And this is Sharad.
Signing off.